That noise, what's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
Now, you want to run the story? You got 5 hours until 8 o'clock. Go get the story.
We're after circulation. What we need is fireworks. People have been hit with sledgehammers. Start arguments.
Oh, I can do that. I know this town inside out.
The Week in Review. I'm Steve Scher. Knute Berger is here. He writes at Crosscut. Eli Sanders is here, associate editor of The Stranger. Joni Balter, who is the host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel and writes for Bloomberg Views. Good to see you all this morning.
Nice to be here.
Good morning. See you, Steve.
So everybody knows what happened. Tuesday, horrific crash at Como. Como TV helicopter crashed into Broad Street off Fisher Plaza right near the Space Needle. The NTSB is investigating. We could get a preliminary report. Comes out today. David Gonzalez is a student who witnessed the crash. He was having a smoke outside Fisher Plaza when he heard the helicopter lift off, heard a strange noise, and saw it all unfold as it crashed onto Broad Street.
And I saw it break apart, and it hit the red car. And as it hit the red car, the car did a 90-degree angle. Like, it moved it. And it landed in between the red car and the gray truck. The guy in the red car got out, like, 2 or 3 minutes later. He was struggling really badly. He was bleeding from his head and his... His shirt was on fire a little bit, and he collapsed.
A man in the red car is Richard Newman. He escaped with burns, cuts, bruises. He's in serious condition at Harborview. Pilot Gary Fitzner and photographer Bill Strothman were killed in the crash. Memorial services for Fitzner tomorrow at noon at St. Joe's in Issaquah. And there'll be a service for Bill Strothman next weekend at Bothell First Lutheran. You know, there's not much to really review on it, only to note it, and to note the passing of these people and note what happened, because it was a huge news story. But there is the question that people are asking, whether helicopters should still fly. We talked to a helicopter pilot out of Los Angeles, Ted Welk, Lawrence Welk's grandson, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he said, look, you know, I cover auto crashes that are horrific. I cover boat crashes that are horrific and house fires. This was a terrible, terrible tragedy, but it's nothing that we should say, oh, let's ban these flights now. But that is what's being considered.
I don't think it's a bad idea to review when and how these are used. One of the interesting parts of the inquiry is something to do with a crane that was in the area. So I don't think it's a bad idea to stop Take 5 and start thinking about sort of when and how helicopters are used. Do we overuse them? Do we send them on too many, you know, runarounds, or are they used appropriately? I don't think that's a bad idea. And I think immediately Cairo said, and I don't know if they're finished with this, that they would take a look at the use. The mayor wanted to make sure that helicopter landings in the city, especially for the broadcast, were safe and that there were not interferences. And then in this morning's newspaper, they were talking about sort of the fatigue potential here, fatigue factor for the folks who were in the helicopters. So there's a lot of things to discuss. I think that it's natural to want to review.
Yeah.
You were talking about the attention paid to the two people who were killed in the helicopter crash, and I think obviously part of it is that it was a horrific crash, and then another part of it is the idea that journalists are public servants, and so people pay attention more when this happens. But it's worth mentioning that Mr. Newman, the man who's critically injured, is also a public servant. He works, and the county put this out, he works for King County Public Health part-time doing HIV testing.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
On your way to work. I was thinking about the people also who are in the two cars behind that caught fire and had to get out of their cars. Some of them weren't found for a few hours, and they were wondering if those people had been injured. It was just a horrific scene.
Well, obviously, it was a shocker for the whole city, but let alone for the people actually sitting there on their way to work. You don't expect a helicopter to drop out of the sky on top of your head. I think that the regulations that they'll be looking at particularly have to do with, one, there's a question as to whether helicopters in general, how safe are they in terms of the number of accidents involving not just amateur pilots, but involving medical helicopters and that kind of thing. So there's pretty significant death toll, and I think that's one of the questions that'll be looked at. The other thing is the use of helipads in the city and where those are. And used to be able to have private helicopters. I remember Dave Sabe had his headquarters down on the waterfront.
Right.
Yeah, and he used to go on business trips. And I had an office one time on South Queen Anne that looked right out at Dave Sabe's helipad, and it was, helicopter was taking off. They restricted them some years ago so that it's basically medical helicopters, law enforcement, and news media. And the adjacency of the Como helipad to the Space Needle, I think, is something people ought to think about. The accident could have been far worse if it had been a summer day, the sidewalks there packed with tourists that come in from the cruise ships and other things. Whether or not you can also say that the helicopters there, anybody who's been a regular at the Space Needle, and I used to have my desk there at the observation desk.
That's right.
He has the coolest offices, this guy.
So, right. I've been out of there a zillion times. And, when those Como helicopters take off and land, it's very dramatic. Everybody stops and looks up. It's loud. That's mainly the thing. And it's kind of exciting. And one of the reasons it's exciting is you don't think about them crashing so much, but it's precarious. It's an aircraft landing on top of a building that's just – a few stories up. And so there's a kind of exciting.
It is exciting.
To it, there.
It is exciting, but it is interesting.
But I don't have an idea of what they should conclude. But I think Joni's right. It's totally appropriate to look at the policy and see if it makes sense.
Welk had said that some people suggest you take off and land from airports. And he said, sure, that there's some sense in that. They're prepared. But, there's fuel trucks at airports. There's airplanes at airports. Imagine if a helicopter had done the same thing at an airport.
Well, presumably you'd be away from that for your takeoff, right?
Presumably.
Has everybody here been on a helicopter?
I have never been on a helicopter.
I was on a helicopter once on assignment back when newspapers used to spend and spend on stories. The story was an early snowfall trapped a bunch of hunters. Up in the mountains, and they were ill-prepared, and so we helicoptered in there. And it was kind of crazy because it was about 3 feet of snow, so it was just unbelievable. Mm. That was back when we would spend a little cash.
I was on a helicopter once at Fort Lewis, one of those helicopters with two sets of rotor blades above it. And they were showing, I think they were showing off that helicopter, but also the Stryker units. So this was way back.
Mm.
But it's a weird sensation.
Well, they have really legitimate uses for all of the reasons. And anybody who went down to the Seahawks parade, you saw kind of a crowd of helicopters, or whether it's an event like WTO or something. There is a way that that media, law enforcement, and others have reason to use them. They're incredibly useful tools. They used to be really important in traffic reporting, keeping the city moving, being able to provide. You can do that with remote cameras and such in a way that you couldn't do before. But
well, I just was going to say the other thing, the other part of the story was that watching Como have to cover that story.
Oh, my. Mm-hmm.
That
yeah.
was hard.
Oh my.
And they, I think the number two or three most emailed Seattle Times article was about how the headline was Como puts emotions on hold as they cover the story.
Well, did you see part of that story was that Dan Lewis was apparently ready to leave Seattle that day
to
interview Obama,
yeah.
And comes back and says, I have to be here. And I watched a little bit of him there. And he did quite a job. And he went between just sort of straight delivery of the news to just the look on his face, which was just so pained. For how he was going to, get through this.
Yeah. The other thing that happened this week, and it kind of got buried and swirled with the Como accident, it was Jim Compton's death. TV journalist, former city council member. He was found dead in his car Tuesday morning, 72. Presumably suffered a very sudden heart attack. He had a long career in journalism before politics. He was a foreign correspondent for NBC News. He was a reporter for King. Reading the stories of how he could speak all these different languages, how important he was to King when some story would break was very, very interesting. He did a lot of in-depth analysis as well on the Compton Report. Here's just a little bit of that.
From King 5 News, this is the Compton Report.
They say politicians are the problem. And shouldn't we send somebody back there who's fresh and isn't kind of steeped in this political garbage?
That's how he talked. He's a guy who people seem to have a lot of good stories about. And Mike Jameson had a great story in Crosscut remembering him, another King 5 anchor. Did you know Compton as a journalist?
Well, yes, I did, both in terms of I was never a colleague of his, but we certainly covered him when he was in politics and in journalism when I was at The Weekly. And Jim was also a big supporter of Crosscut, you know, very encouraging to our efforts there. And so I saw him at a number of mostly social occasions, and we would talk. You know, I had a chance to talk to him some time ago about the book he was working on. He had written a book, apparently finished it right before he died, a book on the Modoc War.
Yeah, in Oregon.
In Oregon and California, yeah.
Captain Jack.
Captain Jack, yeah. And so that's a subject actually of great interest to me. So I'm hoping that sees the light of day. The thing about Jim Compton, most of us know him from King and the Compton Report. And it's just a reminder of the kind of investment that King Television used to make in public affairs and in top quality staffers, who people who really had a really had a background, and he was always very intelligent. I really missed the Compton Report when it went off the air. I was kind of sorry that he went into politics.
Perhaps he was as well.
Well, yeah, I'm sure he was slightly disillusioned. But you know, he did some good things while he was on the city council. And one of the things that he did was he really, after WTO, he helped lead up the dig in to what went wrong there in a way that I think a lot of people would have preferred to kind of brush that under the carpet. He got in trouble with some of the Strippergate scandal, and I think that tainted things for him. But I don't think anybody really questioned his personal integrity.
No, but that
was more of a mistake.
I remember interviewing him then, and that just – you could see how much that rankled him, that the questioning of his personal integrity was just something he was not at all happy about.
I would like to elaborate on the King and the public affairs and the sort of the weighty journalism that came out of King in those days. And if you remember some of the folks who were there, I mean, this was a really serious news and public affairs operation. The two Royer brothers, if you recall, Don McGaffin, Mike James, who wrote that. I mean, these folks, this was, you know, they had bureaus, as Jim Compton set it up, I think, for King in D.C. They were in Olympia. It was a different sense of covering news, and they were, you know, in depth quite a bit, investigative as well. Quite a force in the city, if you think about it.
Yeah, if you just try to imagine a local news station hiring right now a man with foreign affairs experience who can speak Arabic, or a woman or anyone, you would say, why would a local TV station even want to do that? You don't need it for this. And back then, they thought that this would help them. It's also interesting to think that technology has only gotten cheaper in terms of what's required to get news out. And the station's pockets have only gotten fatter with the change to political advertising rules. There's a tremendous amount of money that comes into these stations. And at the same time, the quality of their coverage, when you look at it over a long period of time, is changing in a direction that's not for the better. And it's, I think even, well, I don't know, but it's important to ask why.
Yeah, every year when there's one of these political campaigns, some big initiative that just, you know, millions upon millions of spending, it's like, where does it go? You know, what are you spending it on? Because there's a lot of, like, you know, like every year there's like a blip if there's a big initiative on the ballot. It goes to TV stations. What are they doing with it?
Yeah. I do remember interviewing Jim Compton, and for both as a journalist and then later as he entered politics, and being very nervous about the quality of my questions.
He'd say, Steve,
yeah,
that wasn't a question.
That was a terrible question. Let me tell you how it's done. He never did that, but you because he was one of those people who's a role model. All right. We say goodbye to them, and we'll take a break. This is The Week in Review. It's The Week in Review from KUOW Seattle. I'm Steve Scherer. Knute Berger is an author. His last book was about the history of the Space Needle, called Space Needle, right?
Space Needle, Spirit of Seattle.
Spirit of Seattle. Thank you. I apologize. And Joni Balter, who writes for Bloomberg Views and is a news analyst at KUOW, and Eli Sanders, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. And he's an associate editor, assistant editor at Stranger, associate editor at Stranger.
Associate editor.
Yeah. Jesus. I'm doing bad today. James Johnson, the justice, he said he would retire effective April 30th. He cited health issues. He had missed oral arguments recently, and he had a court spokesperson said he would likely miss much more of the winter term because of his illness. Johnson was a two-term court member. He was a strong supporter of property rights, law enforcement. Eli, you'll appreciate this. He advocated for more transparency in government, but he also supported bans on gay marriage. He said gays had the right to marry someone from the opposite sex.
Right. Well, that's what I was going to talk about, actually, with Justice Johnson. He was, along with Justice Sanders, who some people may remember is now no longer on the court, was kicked off by voters a couple of years ago. Justice Sanders and Justice Johnson were the conservative core of the state Supreme Court. Justice Sanders was replaced by a much more liberal justice, and Justice Johnson, maybe also when the election comes up in November, and we'll see who the governor appoints in the meantime in his stead. But yes, Justice Johnson needs to be remembered for his decisions as well, and one of those decisions was the gay marriage decision in 2006. A majority of the state Supreme Court was opposed to legalizing gay marriage at that point. So he was in the majority, but he wrote a separate opinion where he used language that Chief Justice Barbara Madsen said went beyond the pale, was totally inappropriate in her wording. And he talked about the unique and binary biological nature of marriage and its connection to responsible child rearing. And you don't even have to be gay to find that a curious or objectionable statement. What about all the people who are married and don't have children? Or what about the people who are married and want to have children but can't because of fertility issues? So he was a little out there on that. And it wasn't just gay rights. He worked against the Bolt decision and the efforts to preserve the treaty fishing rights of Native Americans. He was not in favor of that. He was very, very conservative and, you know, based on the statement that you read, a little dismissive of people's rights.
I was surprised that he had worked for the AG's office for 20 years, mostly on environmental issues.
Under Slade Gorton. Under Slade mostly, Gorton. Well, a lot of it related to this issue of treaty fishing rights.
Yeah. He is an Ingram High School graduate, Harvard and UW. He was elected to the court in 2004, so now considered the most conservative justice on the court. So what does that mean for the politics of this?
A couple of things going forward. So Jay Inslee, who also went to Ingram High School, is probably not going to appoint a conservative to fill in between now and November. And sometimes just being in that job and having your name stated a couple times is an advantage when another election comes in November. He was the most conservative person on the court. A lot of people think that's a good idea to have that sort of push-pull, at least in the discussions, at least stretches the debate in a direction that it might not go. I would also point out that in private practice, he was supportive of a lot of things that Tim Iman was involved in, Initiative 601, which had iterations later than with Tim Iman, not originally. And 747, some of the property tax measures. And so he was active in those as well.
Yeah. That is important to remember that Inslee will appoint somebody.
The process is the governor appoints a replacement, and then that person's up for the has to run in the first election, which is coming right up. So, and usually the person appointed by the governor wins that election. It's very, right? Very usual for that to happen. So one of the key issues is he is considered to be the most conservative member of the court, and it's coming at a time when a lot of conservatives, Republicans, are upset about the McCleary decision, feeling that the court is overreaching into the legislative role, and there's been talk about pushing back and trying to get more conservatives elected to the court. So
I was just going to say
they've lost an ally.
Yeah.
And we have a liberal Democratic governor who's going to appoint somebody, I'm sure, who's much more in line with that. But we'll see.
Although history suggests that it maybe is not always the best idea for a liberal governor to appoint a justice who's perceived as very liberal for a position that's been vacated, especially by a conservative justice when you're dealing with a statewide election. the way that Justice Richard Sanders, the last of the conservative duo before Jim Johnson to get booted off the court, the way he got on the court in the first place was because someone retired and a governor filled that vacancy with a woman named Roselle Pekelis. And she was a very liberal Seattle lawyer and judge and had previous judicial experience and was very good on the court, was, you know, endorsed by a lot of people. But it was perceived that the governor had crammed in, you know, a very liberal judge without the people getting to vote on it. And so when the election came up, Justice Sanders was able to exploit this and say, well, the people really need to get someone who's in line with their views. And so the advice to Inslee, actually, based on that experience, might be, don't grab someone who is perceived as incredibly liberal. Grab someone who is perceived as moderate to a little more conservative than you would expect for...
so they can take the hit, so they can take the challenge that is, yeah. You know...
Right, so that they can win election in the fall.
Yeah. By the way, didn't Johnson also win? Wasn't the other issue when his first when his election came up the first time was that there was another Supreme Court justice named Johnson, and there was an argument that people didn't know who they were quite voting for?
Well, that's one of the issues with voting for judges.
In general?
In general, because that you're thinking of Charles Johnson.
Yeah.
Right?
I think so.
Yeah, and there was another Johnson. It's a good name.
It's not a bad name.
Supreme Court in this state, the name Johnson seems to help you.
And I believe Charles Johnson got on the court in a lot of people's minds just because his name was more appealing than the name of the person who I can't remember it now, but who ran against him.
I believe you're right.
I'll look it up and find it.
You know, just on that note, when Jim Johnson had been opposed and is opposed to the expansion of those rules, he wrote about the McCleary decision and also the legislature's being required to come up with an April 30th progress report. He said, This court's exercise of continuing jurisdiction in this case usurps what is intended to be and what expressly is a legislative function and duty. And that is, as you said, Knut, that's going to be the argument that's going to be made on a number of issues as we get closer to the election again. So, just interesting. David Mosley also stepping down as chief of the Washington State Ferries. He was appointed in 2008, shortly after Paula Hammond, he pointed this out, ordered the docking of the 82-year-old steel electric fleet because of safety concerns. I think we remember what that happened. When he was elected, he said he had four priorities: build new ferry boats, preserve and maintain the ferries, improve relations with ferry communities, and get a sustainable, dedicated funding source for capital and operating. I wanted to play you. We talked to former DOT chair Doug McDonald about that, and he said that Mosley had done pretty well in the first things, but like many people in the state, stymied by the funding issue.
The legislature decided to build a new ferry boat that we have no plan to have operating money for, is putting a $5 surcharge on every tab renewal in the state of Washington. And that's going to raise enough money to build one ferry boat. That's a reasonable tax to put on people all over the state. It isn't going to be spent on fixing the potholes on your road. Well, how long can you do that and keep raising the ante for everybody else to support the ferry system?
I want to make sure you heard he said he was asking that question, if that's a reasonable tax to put on everybody in the state.
What was a sleeper? I didn't know it until I read it in, you know, looking ahead to this show. So that it was sleeper. I did not know about that. But it did give David Mosley the ability to say that he has six ferry boats either funded in the process or being built. And, you know, we've been stalled many a time on actually building ferries, so that definitely goes to him. He also had the unfortunate or fortunate, I'm not sure which, decision to announce that he was leaving on Tuesday, which was that big news day. And so he got just a little lost in some of that.
You know, Mosley came out of Seattle politics too, right? He worked with Charlie Roar.
Oh, yeah,
he was part of the redevelopment of what used to be called the Regrade. I realize we don't call it the Regrade anymore. Yeah, South Lake Union.
It's such a weird term if you think about it, but yeah.
Was he a good ferry chief? I mean, at all? What do you guys think? It's hard to tell. What do you think?
Well, it struck me that he was very good.
Lasted longer than many.
He lasted longer than most. I think he was in the job 6 years.
Yeah. And most are two to
four
three.
Or five or, or
like
less.
School superintendents.
Right.
Years.
It's a thankless task in many respects. You're sort of a stepchild of the Department of Transportation, which is mainly, you know, roads and bridges kind of guys. And the roads and bridges kind of guys are always trying to get rid of the ferries by, you know, every 10 years or so they resurrect a scheme to build bridges instead of ferries. You know, let's just put bridges between the San Juan Islands, or let's, you know, put a bridge to Bainbridge or whatever. So you have that kind of thing there. Very few people relative to the rest of the state take ferries. So, I mean, we all might take one occasionally, but the kind of people who actually use them for commuting is a fairly small, concentrated group of people on Puget Sound. And so you get a certain amount of pushback from people in eastern Washington or elsewhere who don't ever use the ferries. And, of course, there's been this trade-off over the years, which is, you know, we'll fund your roads in the Palouse, but you have to fund our highway system, and they are considered part of the highway system. And we will name your ferry boat after an eastern Washington county. So you have the Spokane and the Walla Walla and the Klickitat.
Is that one of the deals?
And the Kittitas. Well, it's awfully interesting that a tremendous number of ferries have eastern Washington county names after them.
But the pushback has always been, you say they start talking about bridges, but the pushback has always been that in Washington, and probably not in many other places, the ferries are part of the highway system. They're viewed that way. They're structured that way. And so that is definitely, you know, part of this discussion. So they are viewed that way.
Back on
And one more thing I just wanted to say is that it's really – I just thought it was a little bit breathtaking after folks had said that they were not going to pay for any transportation and then run on it this year. This one got statewide support. So,
exactly what I was going to say. I like the legislator who joked, yeah, we did pass a transportation package. Yeah. This is it.
Yeah. We're going to build one ferry boat.
On car tabs.
Yeah, but not pay for to operate it.
The thing is, the ferry system is always going to be problematic. There's always problems between the people who use it. They don't feel it's too expensive or they don't get enough service. Certainly things like mistakes get made that get a lot of publicity. We just had a story last week where we found out one of the ferries that was in for repair got a hole drilled into its hull.
You have a problem with that?
So... water came pouring in.
That was by the guys who designed the pontoons for 5
So there's some other major ferry issues, and I'll name one that's literally right in our front yard, which is Coleman Dock, part of the whole waterfront redo. They want to redo Coleman Dock, redo the way. It's a heavily used commuter and auto centric activity on the waterfront. How is all that going to work out? So you need someone to run the ferry system who is very smart, engaging, which I think one of Mosley's skills was at dealing with all the different constituencies. He seemed to get very high marks for that. And also making progress on issues that tend to seem kind of intractable.
Yeah. Well, interesting. Well, maybe it helps to come out of a political background in that sense if you're going to be part of that. Also, we talked to City Councilmember Shama Sawant this week on the record about why she's changing her approach, talking about a phase-in of the $15 minimum wage.
The legislature decided to build a new ferry boat that we have no plan to have operating money for.
But not that one.
But not that one. That's the wrong one. Let's try that again.
Big business should go to 15 immediately. No tip credit, no total compensation, no training wages, no teenage wages. The reason we're talking about small businesses phase in is because we want the conversation to move forward, but more importantly, to move forward in the right direction for workers.
Now, we've been talking about this ourselves for the past few weeks, and I believe all three of you said last week we would see this sort of shift to a phase in, though she was focused, Shama Sawant, in her point that big business should do it right away.
Should get cracking. I did a long interview with her this week. And I used the word moderated when I spoke to her. I see some of the other journalists said tempered, changed position. But I did learn in the course of that interview that moderated was not a good word in some ways.
She didn't like it.
She didn't like it. She took it to that, you know, she was worried about the connotation of sellout. But the fact is she did moderate, temper, or change her position to something that could actually work for some of the small, or as she has also said, very small businesses. as we have said before, generally speaking, when you raise the minimum wage, especially that amount, a phase-in or an exemption for a small business is something that is naturally going to come up. Now, be clear here, nobody knows what small or very small business actually is. Is it five employees, which they use? Was that for sick leave? Or is it 10? Or what is it exactly? And I asked her that question as well. And she said she didn't know. We do have to keep in mind in this conversation that Shama Sawant, while very important in this discussion, is one of nine council members. And nine people get to vote on it.
Well, that's the question I was going to ask and as, answer this as you comment, Eli. But who's leading this now? Who's the leader?
Well, the committee, I guess, which the point has been to the point of the committee, I think, has been to diffuse the sense of leadership. And on that question, I would come back to something I said last week, which is that the moment is ripe and by design, I think, for Ed Murray to step in and be the leader. He's said that we are going to make a decision on this in April, and so this will turn for a little while longer, and then in April he will step in, I would hope, and provide some leadership on this. I agree with Joni. The devil is going to be in the details about what exactly constitutes a small business. Everyone can kind of wrap their heads around what a big business is, Target or Best Buy or something like that. But you start going down from there, and it's hard to figure out when exactly you get to small. On the question of moderation, I saw Sawant speak on Tuesday night at Town Hall. She was doing an event with Charles Mudede of The Stranger about socialism. Why now? Why is it so striking such a chord right now? And what does socialism mean to Shama Sawant? And I found it really interesting because you could not describe anything she said at Town Hall as moderate. At the same time, she has found a very good way of being pragmatic in terms of moving the ball forward on what she wants. She is able to find a middle ground on this question about small business or big business and move it aside so as not to derail the $15 an hour push. And doing that at the same time as she'll stand up in front of Town Hall and say essentially that what she wants is a worldwide socialist revolution and talk very eloquently about why that would be a good idea. There are not very many people who can walk and chew gum that way in the same time, politically speaking. And I think a lot of people thought all we'd hear from Sawant on the council was, you know, a demand for worldwide socialist revolution. She's much smarter than that. She's proving much more savvy than the caricature.
I think part of that I'm interested in is the who holds the power if it goes to the ballot? Because as you've been doing this breakdown of the electorate in Seattle and who votes and where they live, it's not necessarily a given that there's a majority of people who will vote yes as the nuances are discussed.
Well, Seattle voters do pay attention to both the big symbolism, but they also pay attention to details. We often talk about how Seattle, hasn't met a tax it didn't like. Well, we have met taxes we didn't like. The latte tax was a good example. And that was everybody thought, well, we'll tax coffee a little bit and we'll fund the money to kids and that'll be a slam dunk. Well, it wasn't. People objected to that. So I think on the $15 an hour minimum wage, as I said last week, it's a great campaign slogan. And I think a lot of people think that's a great idea. And then when you get into the details of what constitutes a big business versus a small business or a corporation versus, you know, is a family owned business with 10 employees or 100 employees? Is that locally owned, multi-generational? Is that a big business or big, scary corporation? Or not? Or is it just and there's no real way you can citywide you can make some of the distinctions that you might want to make in terms of saying, well, we're going to make McDonald's do one thing and everybody else do another. So I think it's worth getting into the details. And I think Sawant was very both smart and realistic to say that she's going to see that there are maybe not exactly shades of gray, but she's willing to make distinctions. And that, in a sense, the will give permission for the people who are making distinctions, an opportunity to make more distinctions. So, on the idealistic sense, I think most people in Seattle are for a $15 minimum wage. But when you get into the details, those constituencies begin to kind of break into fragments. especially because we tend to be for taxes that we think that other people are going to pay.
Well,
and this isn't a tax, but it's many of the people out there own restaurants, nail shops. You know, there are a lot of people out there who would be hit with these expenses.
Well, a couple thoughts here. One is that what about franchise owners? So they work for very big businesses, but they themselves tend to be really small and vulnerable in this situation. So it's unclear how that would play out. The only other thing I just wanted to say here is that so Shama Sawant is one of nine council members, but behind her is this initiative that looms as a sort of a threat to the mayor and his committee. If you don't do a lot, then we'll come at you with this. But that's where the Seattle voter comes in. If a couple of these end up on the ballot, they will pick a nuanced position, and that's back at the folks who say it has to be one way or another.
That's right. They could do that, right? The council could put something as well as the voters.
And in terms of thinking about this as a tax or an increase on expenses for some people, Danny Westnate had a good column on Sunday that looked at all the taxes that may be on the ballot or at least under discussion. So we've got – I don't think it's accurate to call minimum wage increase a tax exactly, but that's going on. It will create more expenses. You've got the vote on Metro funding coming right up. You've got Burgess's push for universal pre-K. That's going to cost tens of millions of dollars. And there was one more that was on that list, but we had...
Well, we have a higher families in ed, we have parks, we got...
Oh, there's the parks.
We got
parks.
A lot of stuff.
So
parks
there's a lot
new,
coming
yeah.
up in terms of, and all of them you can make a great case for. You can also make a case, and I won't do it right now because there's not enough time, that essentially Olympia has shifted a tax onto us.
If he just do the income tax again, brilliant. Brilliant, my friend. Brilliant.
There.
All right, we're going to take a break and come back with some more of these issues on the Week in Review from KUOW. This is the Week in Review. I'm Steve Scherr, Knut Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter here. We got an email from Noel. We were talking about the $15 an hour minimum wage. Since the compelling arguments made in various interviews with small businesses about $15 now were all margin issues, it seems to me that some audited submission of records showing the operating margin of a small business needs to be the front end to the exemption process. And from Walter, since there are nine council members, isn't it to Sawant's advantage to hold the line on $15 an hour? What's the value of consistency and what's the downside to being seen as co-opted? Well, she sort of answered that, not wanting to be seen as co-opted. And we were trying to answer a question earlier about the name Johnson and its relation to being elected to Washington State Supreme Court.
Right. We were wondering what voters do and don't know and do and don't care about when they're voting for Supreme Court justices. First of all, there's a huge amount of drop-off when you get that far down the ballot, so not that many people are voting. But the story on Charles Johnson, who is not the one who retired this week, but the one who's still on the court, the Johnson we still have on the Supreme Court bench, he won in 1990. He was basically a legal nobody. No one had heard of him. And he was running against an incumbent justice with the unfortunate name of Keith Callow. And so voters saw Johnson and they saw Callow and they picked Johnson.
Yeah. Speaking of voting and voters, there are a few articles that caught my eye this week and that we wanted to talk about. Turnout, millennials, and the vote. And the question was who votes and who won't vote. And I thought this was an interesting cut from an article that said talks aim to encourage young adults to vote. The millennial generation includes those born between 1980s and 2000s. Voters between 18 and 24 had a 41% turnout rate in 2012 compared to 66% of those aged 30 and older, according to the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement, or CIRCLE. That's a nice acronym. I like that. This is almost always the problem with young people. The argument that a WSU provost was making was that, you know, these are people who are engaged civically a lot. They just don't necessarily vote.
A lot of folks don't vote in these midterm elections, and that's what's got the Democrats mildly freaked out or completely freaked out, however you want to phrase that, because the folks who don't vote in midterms tend to be young adults, single women, and Democrats, if the president happens to also be a Democrat. The motivation is all on the Republican side, if you think about it, because they're the ones that don't like something. They're 6 years in, they don't like the president. A certain number of years into health care, even if they do or don't have you know, newer, better health care. They don't like what they've heard about health care. So those are the ones that are motivated.
Hmm. Do you see in anything in the millennials something different than in the past cohort of young people, like what we used to be back in the day, 40 years
well,
ago?
Well, yeah, but you can't make assumptions about that. I've talked about this before, yeah. That, you know, in 1972, when 18-year-olds got the right to vote, the majority of them voted for Richard Nixon for president. So it wasn't a thing where all young people were going to vote Democratic. And I'm not saying that's true now. I'm just saying that you can't make a completely broad sweeping thing. The issue the Democrats have is how do you motivate voters who tend to turn out every 4 years to turn out in your midterm? And that's whether that's young people, whether that's ethnic minorities, whether that's working class voter, whatever that is. And one of the ways that that's done in Washington is the Democrats tend to nationalize local campaigns. You know, you hate George Bush, you know, vote for a Democrat for Congress, or, you know, you take those kinds of issues. The problem is when it's an advantage when the head of your ticket, like Obama, is very popular, as he was a couple of years ago. Now that he's not so popular, it becomes hard to nationalize it unless you can tie it to other specific issues. And so that's going to be a trick both locally. We have the one swing congressional district, the first, that's critical, and you have control of the legislature. And that's the challenge for the Democrats, is how do you get your base active?
Another thing you can do is talk about issues that millennials care about. And I think this is a big problem that both parties have. Why isn't someone talking about the student debt crisis? That would get people in the cohort that they're interested in reaching to pay attention.
Well, isn't that what Obama thinks he is talking about? Give America a raise? Isn't that what he's saying? He's people at all different salary levels.
Overtime efforts.
Need more money.
But that's on
a little bit at that. It's not specifically
a little bit,
targeted.
But that's on the wage side. There is a huge problem with student debt in this country, and it's not going to be solved just by raising wages.
All right. Luke Burbank is host of LiveWire on KUOW at 8 o'clock in the evening. He's also hosts the TBTL podcast. Hi, Luke.
Hello there, everybody.
How are you today?
Hey, Luke.
I am living the dream. I am cleaning out my garage in order to have everything moved up to Port Townsend tomorrow. And let me tell you, I might be a hoarder.
Is that right?
Now you're going to become an unhoarder.
You're one of those guys, huh?
Well, I didn't think I was one of those guys.
What'd you find?
Well, a lot of random screws and other things that have...
That's no way to talk.
No, well, that's actually a lot of stuff that we talk about on LiveWire, Joni, on Friday nights.
random
screws that I have lying around. I'm finding these things in the garage that I don't know why I saved. I'm holding in my hand a 3-inch strip of... you would call it plumber's tape. It's that like metal, kind of looks like scotch tape, but it's made of metal and has little holes in it. But I saved for some reason a 3-inch section of it. Like, I don't know if I survived the war and didn't realize there's going to be a plumber's tape drive coming up or something, but I don't know why I did what I did in this garage, but it is really a hassle to undo it.
You sound like one of those guys who says, you never know when I'll need it. And that's why you still have all those old batteries.
And yet I have never once walked into this garage and thought, you know what I need? 3 inches of plumber's tape or an old, you know, 70% used battery or a hairbrush that's in here too, which just seems unsanitary.
You want to look good in the garage.
Are you going to be reporting from Port Townsend for us? There's a lot of news up there we need to cover.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't want to step on the Port Townsend leader.
Because,
of course, that's the way that Port Townsendites, I don't know what we're called yet. But that's the way Port Townsendites get their news. But I will be. I have a studio up there, and I'll be checking in on this show from the sleepy maritime village of Port Townsend, Washington.
Oh, I think it's a churn. There's a churn. I don't know if you know this. Are they allowing? But probably they are going to allow legal pot sales within city limits in Port Townsend.
I mean, I think that's been going on for years.
I put legal in front of it.
I don't think Fremont has anything on Port Townsend in terms of thinking of itself as, a sort of living by its own rules within the state of Washington.
You know, I tried to come up with, That's actually their sister cities, their sister neighborhoods, I think. They're on the official. They're on the official.
Without the bike ride, though, right?
Yeah. I tried to come up with a funny joke that I failed to come up with about Bellevue.
I never let that stop me.
Yeah. Well, Bellevue considering whether they're going to ban legal pot sales within city limits. And then, of course, Jason Pagano came up with a good line, which is perhaps if they also mandate that they sell Fabergé eggs and Neiman Marcus bags in the pot shops.
You know you're not allowed to do that. You can only sell pot products in the 334 recreational marijuana stores.
Well, then make sure they're
high-end
edibles.
Don't think other people didn't think of that.
They should be high-end edibles then. That's all I think.
I'm sure that in Port Townsend, as long as you have a minimum number of dream catchers that are being sold and
well, you're going to be popular there.
Purple berets, I think you – I can say these things because I'm now going to be a resident of Port Townsend. There is a certain kind of there's a certain kind of store that sells mostly – purple items of clothing for a woman of a
those
certain
are called
age.
Husky shops. No.
Believe me, it's not about the athletic industrial complex. It's a certain kind of gal who, at a certain age, decides that the big way to spice up life is to just start wearing a lot of purple. And I'm trying to get into the swing of that because that seems to be a big feature of Port Townsend.
I would like to see you in a picture with a purple beret. That would be nice.
I can get that for the web team next week. Maybe that can be an extra for the pledge drive.
Nice. Very nice. All right, I have a question. I want a reaction from Luke, but I want to ask Knut a question because you wrote this story about the old donut shop, and you have a two-part story there in Crosscut. Three-part? Two-part?
Two.
Two, right. And it raised you kind of ended the first part by raising this question of unintended consequences where – here was this creepy donut shop where runaways and homeless kids would hang out and then get Fagin-like brought into being criminals. And so that was sort of the gist of the story, right? And,
yeah.
And just real quick, why'd you write that? What were you thinking about?
Well, Crosscut's been doing a series on youth at risk, looking at homeless teens and street kids. And I've been taking sort of looking at some of the historical, if you want to call the 1970s and 80s historic.
Yeah, the 80s are history now, Skip.
So I've been looking at that. And one of the interesting things was this phenomenon of a donut shop at First and Pike that became the sort of unofficial office, Cheers bar, headquarters for, street kids in the 70s and 80s. And a lot of those kids were documented in a famous documentary called Streetwise that was filmed kind of right after the donut shop was closed. And it's just really interesting to sort of see how the city responded to street kids then versus now. How are things different? How are they the same?
They were more ostracized back then, right? I mean, it was street kids were like, oh, what are you bad kids doing?
Yeah, there was a lot of people just kind of wanting to look the other way at what was going on. The donut shop was the place downtown where boy prostitutes hung out. Second and Union was the area where a lot of those kind of pickups happened. And the donut shop accepted people of all kinds. But then there was also this criminal element. But a lot of social workers actually kind of liked the donut shop, not because they liked what went on there, but because they knew where to find homeless kids. They weren't a kind of diaspora with smartphones and spread out. There was one place they could go to find a runaway or to get the word out about something.
So I know this is – I just was curious from each of you. But, Luke, let me start with you. And, by the way, it sounded like you were going to get some donuts while you were listening to Skip talk as well. But
I'm not
going
to stop packing my garage just because you guys are doing the week in review.
Yeah, fair enough. Unintended consequences, being a youth. I was just kind of wondering, have you ever heard of that donut shop story? You were – kicking around as a youth then. You weren't homeless, of course, but
I was I will say this, and I'm not trying to conflate my childhood with kids who had real actual homelessness problems, but I can tell you that when I was a kid growing up, it was much more accepted to just run the streets in Seattle, and we would just take the bus as far as it would take us, or we would hang out on the Ave. Or I mean, I grew up two houses off of Aurora Avenue, and that seemed like a normal thing to just walk up and down Aurora when we were bored. And, I find it odd. I feel like we've gotten to this mode now where kids in this world are either way overprotected or way underprotected. I don't know about any kids who are getting the right amount of protection. You know what I mean? Because
yeah.
those kids that are ending up now as part of that diaspora, it's a heartbreak, and it clearly feels like nobody's looking out for them. And yet you have other kids in my neighborhood who their parents have them on two different leashes. You know, it's like I don't know what the in between is, but it doesn't seem like it's happening as much as it should.
You're sort of getting at the overscheduled kids, and there's a lot of complaint about that. On the other hand, it keeps them busy. Right.
Drum being those runaways. Mm-hmm. All right. I was just curious. All right, Luke, get back to packing, and we'll hear you tonight at 8 on Livewire. I appreciate you dropping by.
Yeah, I wanted to mention we have W. Kamau Bell and Sherman Alexie on, and we had them debate who got more screwed by this country. Second time I've mentioned screws on this segment.
That's nice.
Who got more screwed by this country, Native Americans or African Americans? So it's an important, important Livewire.
Yeah. All right. I want to listen. I bet there's a lot of jokes in there.
This is the least convinced response I've ever heard from anyone.
Okay, Luke.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we'll believe it. Well, it's
all
two
right,
great
I'll
guests.
I'll go back to the garage, you guys.
Yeah. Watch out for those bottles in the back. That's
right.
Luke Burbank. He is host of Livewire on KOW's air at 8 o'clock. Records that out of Portland, Oregon, a fine state. Knute Berger is writer for Crosscut and Seattle Magazine. Eli Sanders writes for The Stranger. Joni Balter writes for Bloomberg Views and at KOW. Have a wonderful weekend.
And you too.
You too.
Thank you, folks. This is The Week in Review, produced by Jason Pagano and engineered by Bernard Ouellette.